We will go on to Appeal 083468, Hiswani versus Phoenix Security Agency. Good morning, Mr. Lehman.
May I please the court, opposing counsel? Your Honors, I'm Attorney Matthew Lehman here on behalf of the appellant Ibrahim Hiswani. A little bit of the background of this case. It arises out of violations of the appellant's rights under the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment, unlawful arrest, and attached state claim of malicious prosecution of the appellant.
Now, let me just start you off. Is there some way in which you think you can meaningfully distinguish this case from Bell in terms of whether this is a timely and proper appeal?
Well, I believe, if I recall correctly, you're right, Your Honor. There was an issue with the timeliness of the appeal. That issue arose from the fact that after the statements made in court, we had to go back and verify whether or not those were true. That took us time to research. There were, in our opinion, repeatedly false statements made to the court, which we had to investigate. And as a result, in one case, I believe we missed a deadline by approximately 2 days. We should have filed, I concede that we should have filed a motion to extend the time to appeal, but it did not come to our knowledge immediately that the statements were false. We did have to investigate. I think that the issue presented here and our position is that the trial court abused its discretion by denying reconsideration of our motion for judgment as a matter of law or in the alternative a new trial, where the appellant showed that the defendant's counsel had knowingly and repeatedly presented false information to the trial court, which resulted in the barring of two of the plaintiff's witnesses at trial. I mean, fundamentally, I think what we're dealing with is a lack of candor on the part of appellee's trial counsel.
But here's my problem. In their affidavits, neither Ms. Fira nor Ms. Lopez addresses the question of whether Mr. Hiswani was, in fact, outside of the club on the public way with his firearm, as Officer Cunningham testified. Now, if they can't contradict him on that key point, then in what sense was he prejudiced by Judge Denlow's decision to bar their testimony?
Well, I think I have two answers for that. A, they were there on the night of the incident. Now, we don't know what they would testify to, as we've never had a chance to depose them. B,
well, don't their affidavits give you a little inkling?
It gives us a hint as to what they would testify to, but I don't believe that we have enough information to determine whether or not they would be able to testify to his whereabouts on the night of the arrest, at the time of the arrest. Secondly, there was a large portion of the trial that went to Defendant Cunningham's investigation after the fact, which we found highly suspicious. If the man was, in fact, on the public way bearing a firearm, what was the point of the investigation afterwards, entering the bar, examining the licenses, trying to determine whether or not he had an interest in the club?
Well, some people would maintain that that was extraordinarily good police work.
I agree that you'd rather have a police officer be more careful, but if a gentleman is found on the public way with a firearm, why investigate afterwards? He's committed the crime at this point. What is the point of investigating if he's guilty? We think, Your Honor, that there was
maybe you might be looking for other crimes, too, Your Honor.
Possibly. I mean,
no,
there,
not
there
possibly,
was,
probably.
There was testimony to the effect that he was not supposed to be there, that this was not his bar. All the licenses are in his name. He was a co-owner of the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, there was some confusion as to why this investigation after, if in fact he had committed the crime, why Defendant Cunningham had in fact gone and investigated.
I'm curious why, if Mr. Hiswani was in regular contact with both of the women, as he testified in his deposition, why couldn't he provide the city with more complete contact information?
Well, Your Honor, that fact is actually slightly misleading. He was in contact with them at the inception of this lawsuit, which began in 2005. After that point, he received information that he thought, there was part of the complaint was a civil conspiracy. There was some suspicion on his part that these two women were involved in this civil conspiracy. He did not talk to them for a period of years after the inception of the lawsuit. Secondly, as far as the information that was provided to the court, they repeatedly claim, and I think that they're missing some very important things, in plaintiff's initial disclosures and their supplemental disclosures, which in the record was, I believe, document 164, Amalia Lopez, her entire address, the correct address, was given at 3425 West 64th Place in Chicago, Illinois. Now, I'll concede that Maggie Vera's telephone number was given. That was correct information. Her address, as far as I can find by researching the record, was not given until, I think, shortly before the trial. That being said, there are subpoenas from 2006, 2 years before the trial, with her proper address on, issued by the city of Chicago. They did, in fact, have her address. I think one of the big problems here is that they were, in fact, in contact with both of these witnesses and made statements to the effect that they had no contact with them and did not have the proper information to contact them, which resulted in their being barred from testifying.
But what did that contact entail?
To the best of our knowledge, there were phone calls. Amalia Lopez stated that she, in fact, spoke with an attorney from the city who attempted to schedule a deposition. There was no follow-up to that. Maggie Vera had both paperwork and a telephone call received from one of the city's investigators. I believe her name was Tiffany Bearfield. She said she returned the call and left a message, and there was no follow-up to that either. That is, as far as I know, the extent of the contact. If there's no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Back.
Good morning. May it please the court. This appeal arises out of Mr. Kiswani's failure to provide correct contact information for his witnesses. Throughout this litigation, Mr. Kiswani was fully aware that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26A required him to produce this information if it was known. Yet despite being informed that the defendants lacked the correct addresses, despite agreeing to remedy the situation, and despite being in regular contact with both of these witnesses, Mr. Kiswani inexplicably took no steps to obtain the correct addresses.
So Mr. Lehman is just incorrect when he says that they weren't in contact for years.
The deposition testimony in which Mr. Kiswani indicated that he was in regular contact with both Ms. Lopez and Ms. Vera took place in December of 2006. That was approximately 2 months before we issued the subpoena for Ms. Lopez and 4 months before we issued the subpoena for Ms. Vera, and a total of 6 months before the trial. So we would vigorously dispute the notion that there was some lack of contact here. In any event, it's apparent from the record that Mr. Kiswani Ms. Lopez was his longtime girlfriend. They had dated seriously for 4 years and were engaged at one point in time. And Ms. Vera was Ms. Lopez's sister. These aren't random people on the street. These are, in fact, people that he knew quite well and was fully able to contact.
What about these contacts that he says? You know, the lawyer, one of them spoke with the lawyer, and then the other one, there were...
Certainly.
Do you agree with that?
With regard to the issuance of the subpoenas, it is not the case that we were able to serve those. The subpoena that we issued to Ms. Lopez was returned to us. The process server indicated that the address did not exist. And with the two subpoenas for Ms. Vera, one was to a gated community and we were unable to gain access. And the other, she had attempted on the process server, Tiffany Bearfield.
Right, and I know that was in your brief, but he continues to say,
right.
You know, so... It's just like we're reading two different stories, really. It's amazing to me.
Right. When I think that the affidavit submitted, what's not listed in them is really what's indicative here. What it boils down to is they each allege an instance of telephone contact with city attorneys. In the case of Ms. Lopez, that's something that the city was upfront about. We informed the district court that we had put in a phone call to Ms. Lopez, and this is in the transcript on the first post-trial motion. That Ms. Lopez indicated she didn't know anything about the case and that it was just a coincidence that we had been given her phone number. So that's I mean, to the extent you could call that contact, that's what the phone call referenced in her affidavit is. And it's notable her affidavit doesn't say anything to the contrary on that. It just indicates that there was a phone call and no follow-up by the city, which isn't terribly surprising if you tell the city that you're the, that they got the wrong person. In the instance of Ms. Vera, she alleges that she returned a call to the city, and we're happy to dispute that, but that our investigator never received a follow-up phone call from her. But even, again, if you look at the substance of what's alleged in her affidavit, she doesn't indicate that in this phone call she made herself available for a deposition, that she identified herself as even the correct person, as her sister had failed to do. And at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is, and what seemed to trouble Magistrate Denlow the most, was the fact that no depositions were taken. Even in the pretrial hearing when the judge was considering the motion in limine, his primary concern was, you know, even now, a week before trial, do you have control of these witnesses? Can you bring them forward, submit them for a deposition so we can use them as witnesses at trial? And even at that late date, a week before trial, Mr. Kiswani said that he didn't have control of these witnesses and couldn't do that. So we can go back and forth on the contact and you know, how substantial was it? The city's position that is that it wasn't substantial at all, but at the end of the day, it wouldn't have been enough for Magistrate Denlow. He wanted depositions, and I think that's a reasonable requirement in this situation. I'd like to address an issue that Judge Rovner had started in on at the beginning of the argument, the fact that this isn't actually a proper basis for a Rule 60 motion. And that's primarily because it's raised on an issue that could have been raised on direct appeal. Here we don't have to speculate whether or not Mr. Kiswani could or could not have raised this issue earlier, because in fact he did in his Rule 59 motion for a new trial. Moreover, he still presented no explanation why he couldn't have addressed this issue even sooner, prior to trial, when the defendants were actually seeking to tape these depositions. In any event, following the district court's denial of his motion for a new trial, if Mr. Kiswani wished to raise this issue on appeal, he needed to file notice of appeal within 30 days, and he failed to do that. This reason alone is enough for the district court to deny his motion. In the alternative, should the court consider the merits, we would urge that Mr. Kiswani has fallen far short of alleging facts to establish a fraud on the court, certainly within the Seventh Circuit, and even within the Sixth Circuit, as he has also cited too. Within the Seventh Circuit, I think it's notable that normally to show a fraud on the court, you need to show something that affects the judicial process itself, like bribing a judge or fabricating evidence. But here, the allegations were made in his presence on a subject that he could readily verify. So it doesn't meet the Seventh Circuit's test. With regard to the Sixth Circuit's test, as we've explained, Mr. Kiswani can show neither fraud nor prejudice. With regard to the fraud, I would emphasize that trial counsel for the defendants was forthright with the court throughout the whole process. The court knew that we were seeking these depositions, that we were taking steps to obtain these witnesses. There was no mystery. We weren't going behind somebody's back. We were always forthright. And with regard to the prejudice, as has been discussed before, these witnesses simply weren't going to testify on the material issue at trial, which is Mr. Kiswani's location at the time of his arrest.
Can you enlighten me about this? Did Officer Cunningham's testimony at trial reveal that Mr. Kiswani did not have the appropriate license to be on the public way with a firearm, notwithstanding his work as a security guard?
That is correct. He was a licensed owner of the nightclub, but even being a licensed owner of the nightclub did not allow him to be on the public way with a firearm. And even his work as a security guard, my understanding of that statute is you can go from your home to your place of business, but you can't take detours and side trips with your firearm. So whichever exception he was looking to fall under, the fact that he was on the sidewalk outside of the nightclub made him fall outside of both of those exceptions. Court has no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Amen. I don't know how much time you have left. 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In rebuttal, the rules of civil procedure, which we do understand, state that Mr. Kiswani was under a duty to provide the addresses and the information that he had at the time. which he did. The proper address for Maya Lopez was provided, as well as her phone number. The phone number for Maggie Vera was. And furthermore, they have her proper address listed on the subpoena. I think that the fundamental issue here is that at the pretrial hearing, the statements made by the attorneys were that they did not have that information and no contact had been made. Therefore, they were not able to depose them, and therefore the witnesses should be barred at trial. When we found out that they had spoken to these defendants, we brought our post-trial motion. They came in and stated, well, these weren't given to us until a week before the pretrial motion. Furthermore, Maggie Vera lives in a gated community. That information was left at a gatehouse. We went back and talked to Maggie Vera. At no point did she live in a gated community. At no point was information left at the gatehouse. It was left in her front door. We came back to the judge with that information. They changed their story again. When we asked the judge, what about this fact? What about the fact that the story has repeatedly changed? He said at that point that he was going to take them at their word and there was nothing more he would do about it and denied our motion to reconsider. Board have any more questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.